This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ray McGovern. He's a retired CIA officer, he's a political activist, he's an ecumenical Christian teacher, and he will be speaking today at 1 o'clock in Albuquerque at the Mennonite Church on the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, and he will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, on the topic Niet Means Niet, a Red Line on Ukraine, that's sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations, and it's at 5 o'clock at the Forum. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you were a CIA analyst. You worked in the CIA from 1963 to 1990. What was your job? What did you actually do?
Well, I was recruited shortly after the CIA was founded, and I was told that President Truman and his successor wanted some place to go for a straight answer on things. They knew that if they went to the Pentagon, the Soviets would always be colored as 10 feet tall. They knew if they went to the State Department, they would be always defending their policies. Truman wanted some people who were answerable only to him, an analysis group that would have one part of it, a clandestine collection agency, which would run spies to supply information not otherwise available. But the primary job was one outfit that would tell it like it is, would speak truth to power, so Truman, in the first instance, would be able to make enlightened decisions on what's going on in the world. Now, by an accident of history, when the overthrowers of government and the operational people, called the Office of Strategic Services, came back from the war, it was just at about the time that the CIA was being set up. It was part of the National Defense Authorization Act, the National Defense Act, actually, of 1947. So these folks came back, the OSS folks, and they came back to great applause, well-deserved applause, I might add. But then they said, well, you know, should we hang around? Or, I mean, we're really grateful for the applause, but, I mean, should we go back to our teaching jobs or our law firms or our corporations, or you want us to hang around? And, the question answered itself. The Russians were... Well, they had taken over Eastern Europe, they were threatening the Balkans, they were threatening Italy, for God's sake. And the KGB, the secret police, running all over the world, overthrowing governments. And so it was decided by the people running our foreign policy that if the Russians were going to overthrow governments, we certainly need to be able to do that too, right? Now, the big mistake was made when somebody said, well, where are we going to put these guys? And some... I won't use the adjective, but some idiot said, you know, hey, we're creating this analysis group, and they're going to report on all manner of things, and they're going to have a secret department there to collect information from spies, so it'd have to be secret, and of course, overthrowing governments has to be secret, so let's put them all together and make one big, happy agency. Big, big mistake. A structural fault from the very beginning.
If you were to accept the premise that it is one government's role to overthrow other governments, what do you think would have been a better course of action?
Well, put them in the Pentagon where they belong, you know? There was one sentence inserted into the National Security Act of 1947, and it reads thus, quote, "The Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence as the president shall from time to time direct," period, end quote. Now, that doesn't entitle the president to authorize illegal activities, but, you know, if you're an unscrupulous president like Bush, aided by Cheney, and others, you have the power there, if you have a cooperative director of central intelligence, to use the CIA as your own personal Gestapo, and do not blanch before the word. So, if you want to order these folks to kidnap people off the streets of West Europe, if you want to have them put into black prisons and tortured? Well, if you have an unscrupulous toady as head of the intelligence apparatus, he'll do it, thinking that if the president wants it, the president has the authority to do it, and he'll do it, and we all know I'm not talking theoretically, right? So,
now, did you witness this? I mean, were you aware of this when you were working there?
I was aware of the distortion of intelligence. See, we never had much to do with the operations people. As a matter of fact, the building, when I first came on board, the building was divided in two. There were turnstiles. I couldn't get to the operations department, and they couldn't get to the analysis department.
Interesting.
Yeah, there was a lot of reason for that. Anyhow, for almost all of my 27-year career, starting with President Kennedy and ending up with George Herbert Walker Bush, I was able to tell the truth. I was able to speak truth to power to the degree I knew the truth, and that was a matter of training and a matter of how to read the press as well as all these confidential documents. Toward the end, it became a little bit politicized, and I say when Bill Casey came in under Ronald Reagan and Bobby Gates came in as his sort of enforcer, they saw the Soviets as being 10 feet tall and intent on coming up through Nicaragua and Mexico into Texas and take over the United States. It was really ridiculous. But those analysts who saluted and says, yes, Mr. Casey, you see one communist, you see one Russian under that rock in Nicaragua? I see two. Now, that fellow became a branch chief. Fellow said, I see three of them here, division chief. Right. You know, I exaggerate just a little bit. So, what I'm saying here is that by the time that work had been done, and what had been earlier sort of conscientious, objective analysts had been replaced by careerists who didn't care so much about the truth as they did about their careers, that takes sort of generation. And 81 is when Casey and Gates came in. You talk about 2002 when there was a need for a national intelligence estimate on Iraq, and they tried to avoid it, but the Senate said, no, you have to produce one. What happened was George Tenet, the head of the CIA, came back, and I know exactly what happened. I wasn't there, of course, and I don't know this firsthand, but he sat his managers around this director's office table, and he said, okay, now we have orders. We cannot avoid an estimate on weapons of mass destruction on Iraq any longer, and we have two guidelines. One, the new one has to be done in 10 days, and two, the conclusions have to come to resemble exactly what Dick Cheney said on the 26th of August, wow, 2002, when he got up in front of the Veterans for Foreign Wars and said Saddam Hussein has all manner of chemical and biological weapons, he's close to a nuclear weapon, and don't be deceived into thinking UN inspectors would make any difference. That just gives you a false sense of security, okay? Those were the guidelines. Now,
so basically we're saying we want you to do research and come up with conclusions, and these are the conclusions that you want us to come up with?
Yeah, and that
I
was
I mean, that's as corrupt as it gets.
It is, yeah, and that was new, you see. What I'm trying to
that
say...
That was new.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that if that happened in the heyday when I was working in the 70s, 80s, we would have said, you're joking, Mr. Tenet. Yeah, a good one. Yeah, George, can't be serious. And if he said he was serious, we'd have been out the door. Or at least he would... A couple of toadies would have probably stayed, and we could do this, Mr. Tenet. But he would have known that he had an insurrection on his hands. By virtue of this politicization of the analysis part of the agency, I'm not talking about operations now, I'm talking about, you know, my bailiwick. It had gone on for 21 years, and that was enough to let people bubble to the top and say, yes, Mr. Tenet, we can do whatever you want. And out of that came the very worst national intelligence estimate, wrong on every major count ever produced by the intelligence agencies. And that justified a congressional vote for war. Nothing could be, well, I mean, that's as bad as it gets. And that's when we formed Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and decided that we would try to hold our former colleagues accountable by writing what we knew to be the truth.
Now, when you wrote what you knew to be the truth, and it wasn't just you, there was numbers of other people in your position who knew what was going on, knew that lies were being perpetrated. Heck, I knew that lies were being perpetrated. I remember distinctly watching Colin Powell on that day point his pointers at these vague things on a screen, and you could tell that he was lying. You could tell from his body language that he was lying, and you could tell from all the other reports that had come out from Scott Ritter and everybody that he was lying. You write these reports. Who reads them? What happens to them? What is their effect?
Well, the first report was a same-day report on Colin Powell's speech. It was the 5th of February, 2003. We had arranged with AFP to get that out on what we used to call the wire by 5 o'clock. It was a task because some of us were a little long in the tooth, and we were wondering if it was still up to this kind of thing. You know, it was like analyzing a speech by Khrushchev or Mao or Gorbachev. Well, we did it. We missed the deadline by 15 minutes, but AFP put it out.
What's AFP?
Agence France-Presse. So the French news agency. Now, all manner of reaction came in from Germany, from Italy, from Japan, from Brazil, from Norway, from Greece. But we didn't get any reaction from the mainstream media in the U.S. It was as though we didn't exist. And it is still that way, even though we just produced our 37th such corporate memorandum. 12 years, that's about 3 a year. That's not much. But we don't get any resonance. We get completely ignored because we say the kinds of things that are not in consonance with the main wisdom that is put out by the corporate-owned media.
It's really, I think, daunting and also really important to look at the extent to which the United States and the citizens of the United States are in almost a media blackout because of the corporate-owned media. I mean, we do have, obviously, independent media like Democracy Now!, like a lot of independent stations like this one across the country, but they're a tiny voice in this sea of non-information. And the rest of the world is looking at us like, are you guys nuts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, what I normally say at this point is what needs to be said, and that is, I've been in Washington for 52 years, so I've seen a lot of change. But there's one change that dwarfs all the others in importance, and that is that we no longer have in any real sense of free media, and that is big. That could not be bigger. You know, Jefferson himself said, you know, if confronted with a choice between a government and a free press, in those days newspapers, of course, he'd pick up a free press every time. Otherwise, you get a dictatorship in the government. So the fourth estate is dead. The good news is that there's a fifth estate, and that's in the ether somewhere here, and it's in what you're going to be airing, and it's in Amy Goodman. And so if people know where to look, they can get the real news. The trouble is people don't know, generally speaking, where to look. I just came from Phoenix. I had several sessions with very, very intelligent, very successful people. And I have enough credibility to have made them sit back and say, well, really? That's not what we hear. That's not what we read. For example, the Ukraine. Okay, to take that for example. March, there's a headline in the Washington Post. Putin planned very early seizure of Crimea. Okay. Now, the gist of the article was, on the 23rd of February, Putin gathered his national security advisors and said, what are we going to do about Crimea? How should we approach this? And gradually, of course, they decided to have a plebiscite. It was a big majority for reannexation with Russia, and that's what happened. And so that was the point of the story. Now, I asked people, what's wrong with that? I asked my Veteran for Peace colleagues what's wrong with that, and other people. And nobody really kind of come up with the answer. And the answer, of course, is what happened on the 22nd of February, you know? On the 23rd of February, Putin did do this, okay? What happened the day before? Well, what happened the day before is the biggest putsch, the biggest coup d'etat in human history, according to George Friedman, who runs Stratfor, a very respected think tank. Why was it the biggest putsch in the most, he said, the most blatant coup in human history? Well, there are lots of reasons. We saw what was going on in Kiev. But the main thing is sort of a rendition on, you know, they say the revolution will not be televised, right? Well, this coup was YouTubeized. 2.5 weeks before the coup, Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland is talking to our ambassador in Kiev, and she says, now, keep Klitschko and the others in the wings. Yats is the guy. Yats knows about the central bank. He knows about austerity. He's the guy. Yats is the guy. Okay? So, now that's put on YouTube. First week of February. And when I wake up on the 23rd of February, the same day that Putin convened this meeting, I hear on the radio, there's been a coup. And who's the new prime minister? A fellow named Yats. Yatsenyuk. I immediately wrote an article. Yikes! It's Yats, you know. Now, you know, in the old days, I sound like an old-timer here, but the notion that Yats had been identified by the U.S. Secretary of State as the next premier after a U.S.-arranged coup, well, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind was sort of disqualified him from becoming the prime minister. So, but he became the prime minister the next day, the same day that Putin convened his national security advisors, and guess who's prime minister of the Ukraine now? Yats. So he's our guy, and if I were Putin, and if my naval base, the only one I had in warm water, ice-free, and where I depended on all kinds of facilities, was at risk of joining NATO, which is exactly what Yats said the next day, want to join NATO. And also he wanted to ban Russian as an official language. Well, I would have done exactly what Putin did, out of just being responsible for defending. You know, people say, well, Ukraine, you know, that the Russians look at that as their backyard. Well, it's not their backyard. It's their front yard, you know? Think of where Napoleon came to. Think of where Hitler. Think of where Hitler was pushed back. It was all Ukraine. So, interestingly enough, you quoted the talk I'm going to be giving, which I gave the title, Nyet means Nyet. Well, where did I get that? I got that from a State Department cable out of Moscow, directed toward the Secretary of State. The date was the 1st of February, 2008. How do I know about that cable? Bradley Manning. He gave it to WikiLeaks, right. Okay? Now, is it authentic? Well, if I've seen one Moscow cable, I've seen about 2,000, right? Yeah, it's authentic. And nobody has denied his authenticity. What did it say? Ambassador Bill Burns was called into the foreign ministry by the foreign minister, who at that point was Sergei Lavrov, and who is still Sergei Lavrov. And he said, now, Mr. Burns, here it is February already, and all during January we have heard that you intend to embrace Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And so I am telling you in non-sentin terms, you know what net means? You know what net means? Net means net, okay? If you do that, there's going to be a civil war in Ukraine. We Russians will have to decide whether we will intervene or not. Net means net. Tell your secretary. Now, to his credit, Bill Burns titled this cable, Net means net, Russia's red line on Ukraine entry into NATO. And all those things that Lavrov has said, Bill Burns faithfully adduced. 1st of February, 2008. The 2nd of April, 2008, NATO, at a summit in Bucharest, decided, quote, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, period, end quote. Now, that's 2008, so what's that, about 7 years ago? It should have been clear to any analyst of Russian or Soviet policy that the Russians would react very, very harshly to any attempt to. I will confess to have been impressed by how circumspect Putin has been in reacting to the Ukraine crisis, because he will not be baited into an open invasion of Ukraine. Will he support the folks out in eastern Ukraine? Of course he will. But, you know, when they're branded in U.S. media as pro-Russian separatists, well, you know, you can have all kinds of objectives with brands like that. They're not separatists. You know, some of them might want to separate and join Russia, but Russia made very clear at the outset, we don't want you guys. You stay in Ukraine, okay? And so are they pro-Russian? Yeah, they're pro-Russian. They're Russian stock mostly. But what are they really? They're anti-coup. They don't want a bunch of people who despise Russians. Ukraine is very, very split. And what they removed was Yanukovych, who was friendly and had widespread support among the eastern Ukrainians, replaced him with this guy, Poroshenko, who is really taking his orders from NATO and from the U.S. And so so that's the nub of the problem. The reason I adduce that all is because people who only read the headlines, Putin had early planned to seize Ukraine on the 23rd of February, okay? It was only weeks later that he seized the Crimea, not Ukraine, but Crimea. Well, you know, you get the idea that this is really bad, bad, bad Putin. Bad Putin, he shoots down aircraft. He sometimes has no shirt on, rides a horse with no shirt on. Bad, bad, bad Putin. And that's a very distorted picture of what we have here. Putin is acting relatively responsibly, and he's not rising to the bait. And when they find out who shot down that plane over Ukraine, I think we're all going to be in for a big surprise, because I think our Secretary of State, Kerry, has a habit of rushing to judgment whenever the Russians are involved, whether it's shooting down a plane or something else. And the evidence that he has adduced to blame the Russians for that shootdown, well, he himself says is based on social media, which he has described, he told David Gregory, it's an extraordinarily useful tool. Well, yeah, right. A useful tool for what? When I consider that there's $75 billion worth of money invested every year in intelligence, and when I know, even in my day, what the satellites and the other things can collect over that particular area, which they were, you know, laser-like focused on, I can't believe that if they have evidence of Russian culpability, that they wouldn't out with it. Rather, they're citing social media.
We're talking to former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. I think the other big problem, besides the corporatization of the media and the kind of news blackout that this country is in so many ways, and it has structural reasons. It didn't happen by itself. It had to do with certain kinds of deregulation that happened in the 80s and so on. But the other one is the corporatization of everything else, too, including war. Mm-hmm. So war is now a corporate activity. Jail is now a corporate activity. And it doesn't seem like we're fighting wars because there are evil enemies out to get us, but we're fighting wars because war is profitable. There's a very strong argument to be made for that, and certainly, I mean, if nothing else, even the not fighting of wars, but keeping an incredibly bloated defense establishment in place with, you know, blank checks and untold taxpayer dollars being taken away from things that matter, like education and so on. What do you do about that?
Well, number one, you become aware of it, and that's where programs like this come in, Amy Goodman and others. If people knew that for every dollar they put into their income taxes or whatever, 50% goes to, quote, defense, end quote, which really means our war machine.
Including intelligence agencies.
Including intelligence agencies, yeah. But if people knew that, if people knew that we spend three times as much on defense as the Chinese, matter of fact, we spend as much as all of the countries put together, well, there are opportunity costs there, you know. That means, you know, what happens to our infrastructure, what happens to our schools, and people don't know that. Now, if you take one recent example, we invested some $5 billion in preparing the Iraqi army to be the crackerjack army that General Petraeus and General Allen said it was. Okay. What happens last year when a couple of ISIS people shoot a few AK-47s in their direction? They ran away. Oh, I exaggerate. They didn't all run away. The officers took helicopters out of the area. Okay? What happened? They left all their weapons, their tanks, their personnel carriers, their artillery behind. So, are we going to let ISIS or ISIL or the Islamic State take that? Of course not. So, what do? Our Air Force destroys all these weapons, right? And now, what are we doing? Well, we're selling $5 billion more weapons to Iraq because they have the oil to pay for it. And, I mean, is this a great deal or what? So, who's profiting from this? Cui bono? Well, it's just like Ike warned us about. And most people don't realize that General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, when he said military-industrial complex, be really careful of, he wanted to say military-industrial congressional complex, and he's dissuaded. He said, that's too far. They won't buy that.
Is that right?
Yeah. Now, why did he say he wanted to say congressional? Because, as you can see, to get it elected to Congress, you need a lot of money. Where do you get that money? You get that from the defense contractors and the people who consume 50% of our discretionary budget, and then they appropriate money for more arms, and they make arms, and they sell arms, and they give them to Iraqis, and then they replenish it from Iraqis, and some of that comes back here and behind them and give to the campaigns of these guys. And, I mean, is this a great country or what? It's a circular kind of thing, and, you know, the bottom line is peace is bad for business. Tension, war, really good for business. Look at the way the stocks have gone since the Ukraine has become a real live issue. So
there's a lot of people who have awareness of that, and I think it's important for more people to have awareness of that. But like, if you look it up on the internet, what is the U.S. budget? There's pie charts galore that will tell you defense spending is 20% of the budget, not 50%. Mm. And so, you know, that in itself is a long discussion that nobody's having. Mm-hmm. But if you know, you have this awareness, you have this knowledge, I mean, not only is war controlled by money interest, elections are now controlled
exactly
by money
right,
interests.
Yeah.
What are we supposed to do?
We're supposed to get out in the street. We're supposed to put our bodies into it.
We got out on the street for the Iraq war, and they didn't pay attention. I mean, this is the thing, that I with great respect, everybody from your generation says you got to get out in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about getting out in the street is the power structure ignores you.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do any good.
Yeah. Well, then you have to get arrested.
You think that makes a difference at this point?
I think there's not enough jails to hold us all. I think that, Cesar Chavez used to say, talks and op-eds and speeches, that's really good, but without action, nothing happens. And you can see that Occupy scared the heck out of the powers that be. Why did they institute a law authorizing them to use the United States Army to suppress dissent? Because they were scared, okay? Now we have to make them know that they have good reason to be scared, that the people that fought for our independence and our freedom back 230 years ago, that we are direct descendants of those and willing to put our bodies into it. That sounds a little extreme, but that's what it's come to. And, our generation is getting arrested too.
On that note, it is time to go, unfortunately, but I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Ray McGovern is a retired CIA officer. He's a political activist. He's an ecumenical Christian teacher, and he will be speaking today at 1 o'clock in Albuquerque at the Mennonite Church on the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1928, and then tomorrow he will be giving a talk on the topic Niet Means Niet, a Red Line on Ukraine, at the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. It's actually sponsored by them, and it's at 5 o'clock at the Forum at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Ray is on the web at raymcgovern.com. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Most welcome, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.